really what I wanted to do on this record was to try to create, for lack of a better way to put it, some beautiful music for the banjo. That was really my goal. And to do that, I mean, I needed to reach out in a couple of different directions.
How do you get people to like the banjo? No, it's not the opening line to one of the million banjo jokes, but the task that banjo virtuoso Alison Brown has set for herself on her latest release. She had help from Keb Moe, the Indigo Girls, and Stuart Duncan. In her own career, Brown has combined many things we don't necessarily expect to go together. Winner of the Canadian National Banjo Championship, a Harvard degree in history and literature, followed by an MBA from UCLA. In 1995, she co-founded Compass Records in Nashville with bassist and husband Gary West, and it has become one of the signature labels for roots, Americana, and contemporary Celtic music. The latest release from Compass is Brown's own Song of the Banjo, which is both the title track, composed by Brown, and a poem by Rudyard Kipling, which reads, in part, "With my tinka 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 tink, I draw the world together, link by link, yea, from Dellis up to Limerick and back."
I think the thing that intrigued me about that, and the thing that I'm continually intrigued by, is that that poem was written at a time when the banjo was the most popular instrument in America. So it was really a mainstream instrument. That's a lot of what I was trying to do with this record, is create music that for the uninitiated would be accessible and palatable. So for people who weren't used to listening to the banjo, it would be something that they would like and could get next to.
Nowadays, we see people like the Avett Brothers and the Mumford & Sons wielding the banjo on stage. Does that create a little more space for that project of making the banjo accessible?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's absolutely a case of every little bit helps. I remember dueling banjos being on the radio, too. And I think that any time something like that happens, whether it's a film that shines a spotlight on an instrument, Oh Brother did that a little bit, too. Or artists like Mumford & Sons and Avett Brothers are using the banjo, or Indigo Girls, or, you know, Dave Matthews Band when Bayless playing some. I think all that stuff is good. I mean, it's absolutely all good. But, you know, if we could ever get to a time where, you know, the banjo is kind of undisputably kind of in the center of things again, I think that would be amazing. And we probably do have a ways to go on that.
You spoke about putting the banjo in places that maybe we're not accustomed to hearing it. I can't think of two places that would be more unlikely for the instrument than Marvin Gaye and Burt Bacharach. Do you have Keb Moe doing a version of What's Going On? And on the latter, you have Colin Hay originally from Men at Work with an amazing version of I'll Never Fall in Love Again. Those are wonderfully almost perverse choices. Were you actually trying to, like, turn us on our heads?
Well, I don't know. I mean, in the case of the Colin Hay song, I mean, they both kind of had external influences that made them happen. So in the case of the Colin Hay song, I mean, Colin has recorded for Compass since the early 2000s. He was over at the house for dinner maybe about a year ago and just started talking about how much he loved Burt Bacharach. And, in fact, he used to, when he was growing up, he used to sit around with his sister and sing Burt Bacharach songs. And, of course, I loved that music, too, so I just grabbed my banjola and we started messing around with the Never Fall in Love Again, which I just always loved that melody and the lyrics and everything. And so that's how that one happened.
What do you get when you fall in love? A girl with a pin to burst your bubble. That's what you get for all your trouble. I'll never fall in love again. I'll never fall in love again.
There seems to be a little bit of a pattern in the recordings that you made. One unfortunate pattern is that you don't make enough records. It's been 6 years since the last one. There are Alison Brown Quartet records, which are all original compositions, and then there are these ones that seem to be a mix of original compositions and guest spots from some of your very wonderful friends on this particular recording, people like Keb Moe and the Indigo Girls and Colin Hay. Is there any sort of intentionality to that pattern?
Oh, I think it's kind of, you know, whatever it is that seems like the thing that needs to be done at a specific time. But you're right. I mean, it's been 6 years since I've made a record, quartet or otherwise. And, like, we've like to say mama eats last, and it really seems to be true with the label and with the other records that I've been producing, which I've probably produced at least half a dozen records since I've made my own record last.
The Indigo Girls are collaborators that you've worked with before. One of my favorite recordings is the version that you did 10 years ago of a Paul Simon song. And on this one, Carolina in the Pines.
Well, those guys are just like the greatest people. And you're right, I've known them for probably about 20 years and had a chance to play on a bunch of their records. And you're right, we did Homeward Bound together 10 years ago. And I just love any excuse to make music with those guys. And I thought it would be great to hear them sing Carolina in the Pines, because growing up in Southern California, that song was a staple of our version of bluegrass music. And I thought it'd be really funny to take, well, fun and interesting, maybe more than funny, to take the banjo lick that Michael Murphy played and have the piano play the banjo lick and then have the banjo try to emulate the piano part from the original version. So that was kind of the little bit of an instrumental spin that we put on it. With Carolina.
We've been talking mostly about the cover versions, the songs that other people have done, and I wanted to touch a little bit on your compositions, because they are half of the Song of the Banjo CD. You seem to have perfected this style that brings together elements of jazz, elements of Irish or Celtic music, just this kind of eclectic sensibility. Are you particularly proud of any of the new Alison Brown compositions on this?
Yeah, well, actually, the one that I really am maybe the most proud of is a track called A Long Way Gone. That started off as just an A section that I had for a long time, just trying to, it was like this very old tune-sounding kind of melody. And it took me a really long time to figure out where to go next. And I think I found kind of a very unexpected place to go for a B section, but I really like the way that works, so... That one was really satisfying.
Let's talk about Compass Records for a little bit. This is the 20th anniversary of the label that you co-founded with Gary West. And now that Compass has reached a certain milestone, what it even means to be a record label in 2015, in your estimation?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And it's a question we ask ourselves every day. And it seems like the rules and the industry are just changing every day. You know, what we want to be is a great home for roots-based music and to be part of the force that carries this music on into the future. That's what it means to me to be a record company in 2015, to create a nurturing home for this music that I love so much and help kind of play it on forward into the future. How you do that, I mean, it seems like the rules change every day, like I said.
In the world of Spotify and Pandora, we don't seem to be relying on institutions, even if they're institutions as nimble and funky as Compass Records, to make those kind of judgments for us. And you've put all this time into kind of establishing that reputation. And I just wonder how that feels as a business person.
One of the criticisms of major labels could be that they don't really try to engage with their consumer across the brand. They're really much more artist-driven. But then on the flip side, there have been labels like Wind and Hill that were completely brand-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to the point that the artist's picture wasn't on the cover. There's a picture of a bush or a tree or a forest. And I think more often than not, I think that in our kind of music, I think that people are aware of the shop that's creating the music, and I think that people do think in our genre more than in the pop music that my 13-year-old daughter listens to, there is still some value to, you know, the brand that's stamped on that, you know, on that CD or on that digital thing that's traveling around in space. Even on days that are really challenging with Spotify and Pandora and all the, you know, kind of the upheaval in the landscape of the record business, I still think about the fact that I'm just super lucky to be able to do something that I feel really passionate about rather than something that's just a job.
Well, we appreciate the job that you have done, and I look forward to the next 20 years.
Well, thank you so much, Bruce. I really, really appreciate that, and we appreciate your support.